Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on February 13, 2018. This is the week 6 class of our 2018 12-week Dhamma study based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. This class is on the concentration factors of the Eightfold Path. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So why did the Buddha teach meditation? What's the purpose?
For Frank?
Hello, Scott. For concentration. Yes. Did he teach meditation for any other purpose?
Not required.
For me, I think it's where the mindfulness starts. It's paired up with meditation, but I mean, it's where for me where it started.
Yeah. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. We can't do that unless we have some measure of concentration. Lorna?
I think also we get. It's without meditation, I mean, you wouldn't know what a quiet mind was. So it's
right.
The arrow point to where we're going in real life. That's what we're trying to achieve in off our cushion. So, but that gives you the experience of what you're trying to achieve.
Very good.
And it also allows for the insights to take place.
From that well-concentrated mind. Yeah. So everything rests on concentration. And what we studied this week, what you read, is the concentration factors of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And using the word right, wrong, I could just as easily use the words skillful or unskillful as in skillful effort or unskillful effort or appropriate effort or inappropriate effort. But if right and wrong point gets right to the heart of the matter. There's a right effort that we can engage in, and that is meditation and developing the broader framework of the Eightfold Path. And then there's wrong effort, which would be anything that, as far as our Dhamma practice is concerned, takes us away from that that right effort. Let me read the Buddha's words on what are the four developments of concentration. The Buddha's words, there are four developments of concentration. There is the development of concentration that leads to a pleasant abiding here and now. Immediate reward from our Dhamma practice. As soon as we develop even a small measure of concentration, our mind's naturally quiet. And we're developing a true and lasting inner peace. There is a development of concentration that leads to a pleasant abiding in the here and now. There is the development of concentration that leads to the attainment of knowledge and vision. Remember how the Buddha described his awakening was achieving and developing knowledge and vision, but very specific knowledge that is framed by the Eightfold Path, and that vision or insight is insight into three marks of existence. Very specific, very, very direct teaching. There is a development of concentration that leads to mindfulness and alertness. So there's a subtle but very important distinction between concentration and mindfulness. Mindfulness is more of a quality of mind that is rooted in concentration, and you could say that useful mindfulness does not exist without a measure of concentration. How could we hold in mind the important principles of the Eightfold Path if we didn't have a measure of concentration? There is the development of concentration that leads to unbinding and the cessation of suffering. The Buddha directly connects our meditation practice, deepening concentration, with the goal of being unbound from the wrong views that result in suffering. So a mind that is distracted, stuck in chasing after the things that give it pleasure, and being hypervigilant about the things that might take away from its pleasure, misses its whole life. Because that mind is always stuck in the past or thrown into the future. By those two things, by the distraction of the preoccupation of dukkha. Concentration is what overcomes distraction. It all makes sense, doesn't it? I just want to read another quote from the Buddha, and then I want to get into the Samadhi Sutta, if I can find it. So what is right effort? The Buddha's words, one efforts to abandon wrong view and wrong intention and wrong speech and wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong mindfulness, wrong meditation, and develop right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. That's the all of right effort as far as our Dhamma practice is concerned. Where should we put our efforts? Every one of us has probably come up against the struggle of how much time can I actually put into meditating and developing the Eightfold Path. It's a real choice to most of us, isn't it? How much time can we actually do? And carving out that time and actually engaging in our meditation practice and developing the broader framework of the Eightfold Path like we're doing right now is part of right effort. It's part of recognizing and abandoning wrong view and wrong intention, etc., etc. Again, very simple and direct teachings, aren't they? Frank?
Developing the Eightfold Path would be in your ordinary life, wouldn't it? Not during meditation.
Oh, yeah, good. That's a good point. It's off our cushions that we begin to integrate all eight factors of the Eightfold Path. You know, that's what it's there for. It's not just to think about while we're meditating. It becomes the framework for our life. Excuse me. Which is really what we've been doing in a direct and well-focused way this past 3 weeks on all the factors of the Eightfold Path, beginning in right view. And so we've seen how right view is the entry to the Eightfold Path, but it's also the development of a fully awake and fully mature human being. Holds in mind that right view, sees everything from the point of view of right view. The Buddha describes right view very succinctly. Abandon what is unskillful. And develop what is skillful, the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, if it were not possible to abandon what is unskillful and develop what is skillful, I would not even teach this. So think about that from the point of view of an awakened human being. He wouldn't waste his time doing it if he didn't think that other people were going to develop this. And immediately he got feedback that it was working, that his teachings methods were working. If it were harmful to abandon what is unskillful and develop what's skillful, I would not teach this. Apply your efforts to develop what is skillful. Be mindful of wrong effort and enter and remain in right effort. This is one's right effort. Simple and direct. Did anybody have any questions about how to do that, or was it possible to do that? Engage in right effort. It can be done, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Some
days better
than struggles, really. Yes. Moment by moment, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. All right, I'm gonna everybody read the chapter, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we understand that the applications of right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation apply to the proper use of mindfulness, meaning as the Buddha taught in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and the Anapanasati Sutta, how to apply those four foundations of mindfulness, and then resulting in the proper use of meditation to deepen concentration. So let me just touch on the Samadhi Sutta. Because I thought that'd be a nice addition to what we're studying this week, if I can find it. So samadhi is a word that is loosely translated to concentration. A better, more direct word is non-distraction. So we're developing meditation so that we can create a non-distracted quality of mind to hold in mind the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path.
That word is samadhi?
Yes.
I thought samadhi was more of a person. It's not a...
No.
No, it's just a...
It's really a quality of mind.
Quality,
and it means... concentration is good enough, but I think a little bit more direct is samadhi is a non-distracted mind. Mm-hmm. So, samadhi is often taught as the end-all goal in some Buddhist schools, but it really isn't. It's really just a well-concentrated mind that is developed through Samatha Vipassana meditation.
Right.
In the Pali terms, what is the antonym to Samadhi?
It could be dukkha. But directly it would be a non-distracted quality of mind.
What is samsara?
A samsara is the ongoing. How the Buddha used samsara is simply the ongoing experience of being stuck in wrong views, being stuck in dukkha. Okay. And the word samsara means wandering, meaning we're wandering in ignorance. We don't understand that we're even stuck in this state of ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
Oh, you don't understand. What happens if you understand that you're stuck in that state and you can't?
Well, that's kind of what we talk about in class often. When we're recognizing that we're acting in behavior that is unskillful, that's recognizing that you're wandering in samsara and you're acting or reacting from that.
Not acting, connecting, like not behavior-wise, but not experiencing it. Like you can experience a peace of mind. You can experience a distracted, agitated mind state.
Yep, that
it's
would.
It's not that you just can't let go. That you gotta. Like, I really have to start thinking about how to apply and cultivate and whatever integrate.
Yep.
What am I doing wrong here? Like, because I'm feeling it sometimes, and I'm like, you know.
You'll catch yourself sometimes.
I experience it at least once or twice a day.
You'll catch yourself from samsara and be like, okay, I can snap out of this.
No, I can't snap out of it. I have to be with it. I just have to not react to it.
Obviously, awareness of the state that you're in.
Yeah, and it's a little bit aggravating. And it adds to it. It's almost like feeding a wood fire. Like I have a wood stove. It's like just throwing more on there. And it's like, all right, just got to stop throwing thought on there.
It's almost like thinking during meditation and bring yourself back to the breath.
Yeah,
that's exactly what Frank is describing. Yeah. The proper use of a well-concentrated mind is first to recognize that you're caught in behavior that is rooted in ignorance.
And be at peace with it.
And that's the most important part, is to be at peace. If you judge yourself harshly simply by recognizing that you're outside of the framework of the Eightfold Path, you're never going to develop the Eightfold Path. Nobody can withstand that barrage from themselves. You can't beat yourself awake. One of the reasons why I say we need to be gentle with ourselves is because of exactly this. Frank is describing recognizing where his thoughts rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths have taken him in that moment. And at that moment, we practice restraint, if we can. If not, it might be the best we can do is simply to recognize that we're in a mental state that is unskillful and continue to cultivate the Dhamma so that we stop putting ourselves there. Again, this is a simple teaching on the Salata Sutta. Then we're not sticking the second arrow in. It has to start somewhere. And it starts, again, tying this week into last week's study, it begins for most of us with the virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, because that's how we'll recognize that our behavior is less than skillful.
I guess it's almost like when I have a problem with sciatic pain sometimes, and it's almost like feeling that intense pain, and then like especially in meditation, feeling it, and then returning to the breath, the sensations in the body, returning to the breath, and not resisting it.
Yeah.
Like accepting it.
Yep.
Is what it is. Because I don't like this and I don't want this pain anymore, and how do I get rid of it, then it seems to intensify.
Yeah. And rather than resist it, we simply acknowledge that this is what's occurring. It doesn't need to be any different. It doesn't need to take away from my meditation practice. Come back to the sensation of breathing.
So Eric had, I know he's listening tonight, but Eric bought me a Christmas present. And it was an acupuncture bed. So it was like a bed of nails. I'm like, so you bought me a bed of nails?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Eric. I always wanted to get your dad one of those, too.
No, I already have one of my own.
Okay, so the Samadhi Sutta. I'm going to say what I just said. So, friends, there are four qualities that are developed from concentration. Concentration, when developed in practice, leads to developing peace and calm here and now, developing useful knowledge and true vision, developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness, and developing the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion. So how does a development of concentration lead to peace and calm here and now? When properly engaged in shamatha vipassana meditation, one is withdrawn from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana. Jhana is spelled J-H-A-N-A, and it's simply another misunderstood word. Jhana simply describes four distinct levels of meditative absorption that every one of us attains at least the first three levels every time we meditate. We just don't recognize it. The word jhana has taken on this a mythical aspect to it that is nearly impossible to achieve, and you have to be a super advanced meditator to ever get there. It's just not something the Buddha ever taught. The Buddha taught these levels of absorption simply that we recognize that our meditation practice is bearing fruit. The first jhana is delight and pleasure born from withdrawal and accompanied by focused thought and insight. That as soon as we begin to meditate and put our mindfulness on the sensation of breathing, we're entering the first jhana. For most of us, it might only last for a split second, but the experience is real, and it's important to recognize that. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the second jhana. Focused thoughts and insight stills. Delight and pleasure born of composure and inner poise arise. And again, we've all had that experience, even if it was only for a brief moment or two. There was nothing that was distracting us in the moment, save for our breath, and even that has fallen aside. Again, just for a brief moment, second jhana. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the third jhana, which is delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure, when the delight and pleasure and the perception of pleasure and pain disappear. In other words, we're simply entering a non-judgmental state. That's also known as equanimity. That state, established permanently, is an awakened human being. As concentration deepens further, they enter and remain in the fourth jhana. Mindful equanimity prevails. Greed and aversion disappear. This is the development of concentration that brings peace and calm here and now. Does anybody think they can't develop that in meditation? And how does development of concentration lead to developing useful knowledge and true vision? As concentration deepens, distractions subside. It's just that simple. As we continue to develop our meditation practice within the broader framework, distractions will subside. And we've all experienced that, right? Correctly? Correct? Yes. As concentration deepens, distractions subside. Even the passing from day to night and night to day is free of disturbance. In other words, whatever is occurring in our minds, in our life, through a well-concentrated mind, even the passage of time doesn't bring a disturbance to us. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. The mind is bright and spacious. This is a development of concentration that brings useful knowledge and true vision. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness? As concentration deepens, the impermanence of feelings is understood. That simple act of recognizing, this goes right back to the Satipatthana Sutta, recognizing that feelings are arising and passing away, and thoughts are arising and passing away, and not needing that experience to be any different than it is, is training my mind at the point of distraction to not be distracted. I'm using meditation properly. I'm noticing that I'm caught up in a fleeting feeling. Come back to the sensation of breathing. I notice that I'm caught up in a whole thought construct, and it might have been stuck in my head for 10 minutes. Come back to the sensation of breathing. That's all that we do. No matter what it is that we're caught up in, a feeling, a thought, or a combination of the two that just seems to be circular and keeping us wrapped up in it, come back to the sensation of breathing. And so we're using meditation to deepen concentration. It does not matter what arises during meditation. come back to the sensation of breathing. If it's something that is singularly important and it's distracting, write it down on a piece of paper and come back to the sensation of breathing. If you've discovered the Higgs boson, write it down, come back to breathing.
Time travel.
Come back to your breathing. And without being too silly, what's more important? Time travel or awakening? I would vote for awakening, although I would love the time travel.
No. Yeah, you could be in tomorrow already.
Yeah, and we could see, hey, Russ, how you doing? You joining us? In the moment, when we're meditating, the most important thing to do is to meditate. Because we're not meditating forever. In a few minutes, we get to what's distracting us. Right now, we're training our minds to deepen concentration. Period. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing refined mindfulness and attentiveness? As concentration deepens, the impermanence of feelings is understood. As concentration deepens, the impermanence of perceptions or thoughts is understood. As concentration deepens, the impermanence of thought is understood. This is the development of concentration that brings refined mindfulness and attentiveness. Again, pointing right back to meditation. Nothing magic about it. Go and meditate. And how does the development of concentration lead to developing the cessation of craving, aversion, and delusion? As concentration deepens, one remains attentive to the arising and passing away of the five clinging aggregates. Five clinging aggregates just simply describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. This thing that I'm claiming is a permanent self, it's just five aggregates that I'm clinging together to describe this ongoing experience of dukkha.
Your ego, man.
Yeah, another word for it. Anatta is another word for it. In a slightly broader sense, karma is another word for it. If you want to know what your karma is, take a look in the mirror. There it is.
John, can you quickly list the five clinging aggregates?
Sure. Form, physical form, feelings. And in this sense, feelings are any distraction in the mind, any disturbance in the mind. Form, feeling, perceptions. Now remember, those perceptions are themselves rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications. Another word for that is assumptions. But again, these are assumptions that we formed about ourselves in relation to the world around us, rooted in ignorance. So the assumption itself has to be an expression of ignorance, isn't it? And that leads to the thing to be most cautious about, the subtle strategies that we employ to continue to ignore our own ignorance. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and then consciousness. But it's consciousness with a small c. It's not some grand consciousness that we should worship. It's a consciousness that we should recognize is ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So thank you for the question. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and ongoing thinking. If you look at those five aggregates closely, you'll realize that they are discrete and disparate aggregates that we cling together to say this is me, this is a permanent self. When every one of those aggregates, when you look at them clearly and in reality, are all impermanent in nature. And each one of those aggregates is always changing and always influenced by either ignorance or wisdom. It's the only choice that a human mind... It's the only choice that a human mind can decide what its influence will be. It'll either be rooted in ignorance, meaning continued ignorance of Four Noble Truths, or that mind can influence itself towards awakening by developing the Eightfold Path. Frank, you had a question.
Yeah, you said the fifth aggregate was consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't the consciousness is the sixth sense? We have
when
five
you look,
physical senses.
Yes.
And the conscious mind is the sixth sense.
Yes.
So, in fact, that would be all physical senses are a bundle of the aggregates.
Yes. Yep, included in the first aggregate when we're describing it this way. What else Frank is referring to is something called the sixth sense base, which is how we come in contact with the outside world. Our five physical senses plus that sixth sense of ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. They're considered, in that sense, the thinking rooted in ignorance is considered a sense because it's what we're interpreting our contact with the external world. And now think about that, and it's an obvious thing, and most of us don't think about it. If what I'm using to interpret my experience is rooted in ignorance, what conclusion can I come to? It has to be a conclusion rooted in ignorance. If I'm giving something that can start framing my thinking towards the way things really are, then I can awaken. And that's the framework of the Eightfold Path. And it really is for that sole reason. And so we meditate when the concentration factors, we engage in right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation to deepen our concentration so that we can support the refined mindfulness necessary to develop fully profound right view, seeing things always from that point of view of understanding and wisdom, knowledge gained, right, as the Buddha refers to it here. So everything in the Eightfold Path, again, is designed towards awakening. Its usefulness is only that. But, it's the most important thing I think any of us can do, can engage in. So I think that's enough of a talk tonight. Any questions about tonight's talk before we go around the room? Ram, good to see you tonight.
These days I'm really struggling with concentration. And as I said before, it just surprises me how it can change so much. I go from days where I can keep things together and have some concentration, and then there's days where I'm just off wandering around. But I'll be back on my cushion.
The important thing. Thank you. Yeah, our level of concentration is likely to be as impermanent as any other phenomenon. You know? And it's important to remember that, too, because we could get very frustrated. You know, having a couple of so-called good meditation sessions where we're just focused on the breath, and then the next one we can't seem to get a minute. You know, and that's just the way it is. It's best not to judge that, even, and just come back to your sensation of breathing. And then engage in further right effort by doing just what we're doing. Reading more about the Buddha Suttas, the Eightfold Path, and striving to integrate that. That's our, as Buddha just said, that's our right effort to do that. Scott, good to see you.
I've noticed since I've been coming to class that I was obsessed with my phone, meaning I was on all these websites, Huffington Post and Daily Beast and all these, and Solana, and I seem to be losing interest in that now.
Good.
Because it just seems like a giant distraction.
Yeah.
From the truth.
Okay. Yeah, that is. Yep.
And all of a sudden, it's not as interesting. And I go through my phone now, nothing. I don't want to look at anything. I just want to, you know, maybe check the weather. That's about it. So so I think
even
that's...
Even that is a giant.
Even that's all right. But I've noticed that, and since I've been coming to class, it really has... I mean, I thought it was just strange. this is actually working. I don't need the distractions anymore. I don't even crave the distractions anymore of that. For some reason, I was craving that before I came here. And now, all of a sudden, I could care less about anything going on. I mean, I don't want to unplug myself from the world.
Yeah.
You know, but I just think a lot of it is just ridiculous. And it just traps you, and it traps you in a samsara cycle.
Yeah.
I think a lot of
Mark Zuckerberg doesn't love you.
No, he doesn't. So, congratulations. Right. That's just how it should work.
You can read about that on my blog.
He got that because he's sitting.
Well, that is.
That's employee of the month.
It's exactly that way, Scott.
Yeah.
And it's so important to recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost seems too mundane to be worth it, isn't it?
Yeah,
boy, I realized how distracted I was.
Mm-hmm.
But it really is worth the price of admission.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the class fee is going to go up.
Now
they got you hooked. And it should be, that's the wrong word. I was going to say it should be that immediate. And it often is that immediate. When you develop a framework for seeing the world that an awakened human being gave us, it's likely that it's going to work, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And you see your own distraction. And you realize that all this time I've been wasting. That's it. So, congratulations. Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here. My mindfulness of the cushion is really focused on things that are outside me that I get caught up on. And that's really how I spot my mindlessness. When I get caught up in things from the world through my physical, and I trace it back through my physical senses. And that's about the end of my mindfulness of the cushion. So when I read the chapter on mindfulness, and it says you should, you know, you could trace your thoughts back to an angry thought or a jealous thought or a this thought or that thought or whatever, you know, there's kind of like a list of different things. I don't do any of that, to be honest. I just, when I'm distracted from the outside, my mind is distracted by the outside world in any way, and I can spot it, notice it. That's when I try to disengage with the feeling or the emotion or whatever. And that's how I operate off the cushion. And reading your chapter on the mindfulness, I wonder if that's enough, because you go into much more detail.
I'm glad you brought that up. To answer your question, yes, it's enough. I didn't mean that we should get analytical.
No.
I just meant to point out that whatever your emotion seems to be, you can always trace it back to something that is declaring, I want this to be different than it is.
Right.
It's always brought, it's always back to that. I mean, that's the essence of an awakened, not the essence, the experience of an awakened human being is that they're at peace with whatever's occurring. And you get there by not having to analyze whatever's going on. You just simply acknowledge it. So that's what I was pointing out, not to get too analytical with.
Good. And then the meditation. Well, I'm a good girl and I meditate. I think that's the challenge. Sometimes that's the biggest challenge of meditation is just, you know, just doing it twice a day. Was your period of time, whatever, and that's what I do, and I do it, and I apply the method twice a day. However, and I do have a quieter mind at the end of the meditation, at the beginning, so it, yeah. But when I'm stressed through the day, I meditate in the morning, which is a quiet time, and you just get up, your mind is not triggered yet. So that's a good time to meditate. In the evening, your mind is quietening down naturally, I think, at the end of the day. Throughout the day, your mind is more active and more thoughts are coming faster and all that sort of stuff. When I try to meditate, when I think I'm sort of really quite stressed, something is stressing me through the day, and I try to meditate to lower the stress, to combat the stress. I'm not very successful at that, to be honest. And it can lead me more to frustration than actual achievement in quietening the mind. So I think my meditation practice is good so long as my mind's quiet to start with. But as I say, when it's really racing about something through the day, and I try to combat it and get my mind back and lower my anxiety and all that. As I say, I'm not always very successful at that, to be honest. That's my position.
Thank you. I know you know this. If you're having difficulty quieting your mind in meditation, you can always start with some metta and just listen to that once or twice, and that will tend to quiet your mind. If you still find that it's just too difficult to meditate at that particular time, don't. You know, do it again in half an hour or so. It's okay to use, in fact, I would suggest to use meditation just like that as a refuge when you're really stressed out. But also understand it might not bring immediate relief. It's not designed to do that. But every time that you meditate, if you're using the method, you're going to be deepening your concentration no matter what seems to be occurring. And in that way, every meditation session is useful and effective. Thank you.
Okay.
Christine, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good. I'm doing good. I missed a few days, so, but it made me grow appreciation for it. I did notice like a huge difference in my days without meditating. So, I don't know. I grew appreciation for it. I'm really just really enjoying the process.
Good. Thank you. It's important to recognize it, just like we were saying, and we should enjoy it. Why shouldn't we? What a wonderful thing to be able to do. I'm glad you're here tonight. Keila, good to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Don't have anything too profound. I ditto everything you said. When the day starts rolling so quickly, mindfulness just dissipates.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find. It's like you're on a merry-go-round, and you have to put your foot out and stop it. And It's really tough. That's I think where the real challenge is. And I guess you're going to say just keep practicing.
Not me. Try something else. Right. A shot of whiskey. That'll calm you down. Yeah, that's all we can do is keep trying. You know, and acknowledge that we found a true refuge that we know works. Okay, I'm glad you're here tonight. David, good to see you.
I find the morning very peaceful because just woken up, your body's relaxed. Mm. I find when I do it in the evening, much more difficult, but that's where I find much more insight because you see all those distractions.
Yeah.
And you're aware of those hindrances. And then off the cushion, I really try to cultivate the seven factors of enlightenment. And I see those things, and it is all connected, that spaciousness, that concentration. I don't mind a difficult session, because to me that's kind of what you're trying to do, is to recognize those things.
Yeah.
So, that's all I've got.
Yeah, that's a lot. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the when we're having a difficult time in meditation, it's just that. It's an opportunity to really gain some insight. And how do we do it? Come back to the sensation of breathing. It just naturally develops. Thank you, David. Mary, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to see everybody. My practice is going well. You know, it's really the opportunity every day to try and live it off the cushion. You know, I have distractions or triggers, like everyone, that you know, pull me off the path, and I'm just much quicker to realize that, and which to me is the realization that I'm holding the Eightfold Path. I'm being mindful of the Eightfold Path because I never recognize it. I'm so out of the Eightfold Path, you know, and then you just want to do everything you can to get back into it. So I still have some of those triggers, and I guess, you know, will for some time, that just pull me out so quickly. But I'm better able to see it. I certainly don't get as excited as I once did, and it's a lot easier to calm down and have right view. I mean, I'm really taking that right view very seriously. So it's just a beautiful thing to experience it off the cushion and to build the rigor and the discipline, the right effort. You know, it all goes hand in hand. So it's just wonderful. So thank you.
Thank you. I don't mean to keep putting you on the spot, but can you describe a little bit more about your developing right view and how it relates to your overall Dhamma practice?
I just heard it differently this time, you know, about recognizing when you're not in right view. I think I thought it was more like, I don't know, but I think right now it's recognizing when you're not seeing things clearly, when you're not seeing either your intention is mucking it up, or the by-clinging aggregates, or you know something is mucking it up, so you can't see clearly, and you know it because you're not on the path. You know, like you're pissed off, or you know you want to kick something, you're really annoyed by someone's behavior, you're physically agitated. Like there's a thousand.
She looked at me.
No. Well, that's you holding a mirror at me.
What are you doing?
But it's a lot of physical things, never mind just the emotional things that are going on in your head, that tell you you're off the path. If you're off the path, you don't have right view. And that's very powerful because if you can give yourself permission to say, I'm not seeing this clearly, because once upon a time you believed you were fully seeing that person was doing this to you, or I don't want to work for that person anymore, you know, those kind of things. And you're just not in right view. And you may not know what right view is in that moment, but you know you're not in it. And you need to get back on the path, and you need to breathe and take a moment while the insight arises, while you continue to experience your life off the cushion, so you get that validation of what is right view in this situation. That's what it's meant for me.
Thank you so much for explaining it so eloquently. How do I know I'm in wrong view? I don't feel good right now.
Mm-hmm.
Something's bothering me. I need something to be different. And I think about that. That's a self-referential view, isn't it? Rather than what's occurring is what's occurring. It can't be any different than what's occurring in the moment. How could it? It's what's occurring. But I can be at peace with it. And it doesn't mean that I won't do anything to make this situation possibly not occur in the future. But I won't create an identity over it being that way either.
And being at peace is a better starting point for making something better.
And all the time. It's always the best response. How can I maintain my peaceful mind? How can I not lose my mind over what's occurring? The only way that I've found is the Eightfold Path. That's why the Buddha taught it. And he understood and taught the reason for my discontent. And I don't need to go any further except I need this to be different. It's more of it or less of it. You know, I need to control this person or this situation. And it all comes back to that. And when I let go of all those wrong views rooted in ignorance, what happens? I'm left with a calm and well-concentrated mind. So Frank, and then Morna.
When you were talking and Mary was talking, I just all of a sudden seen the framework of the four truths and the Eightfold Path within that, like you were talking before about how everything he taught was within the framework of it.
Yeah.
And when Mary was describing right being in wrong view, it's kind of, I just thought briefly that's what Sid was asking everyone to kind of...
Siddhartha.
Yeah.
He was from South Philly.
He's asking everyone to experience that first truth of the suffering. Like the wrong view, I think he puts in direct contact with that first truth.
Yep.
You know, and then tracing it back to the craving, you know, and is that a mind that is looking to satisfy mood, you know, either in trying to make it feel good or... But it keeps on tracing backward to the whole I thing, you know, the whole self-referential thing.
Yeah.
And if I can just keep that sixth sense base, like, you know what I mean, and in mind.
See you, Christine. See you, Keila.
I'll wait till my turn. I'll wait till my turn. I just had that thought come up in my mind.
Good thought. Helen, good to see you.
Good to be here. So far I can relate to everything that has been said tonight. You know, and I think about your connection to things on the internet. It's kind of like junk food. And once you're in a diet of healthy food, you can taste how bad the junk food is.
You can know what is poison.
Yeah, and you know, except for potato chips. saying earlier on about the awareness of being in the wrong mental state. You know, right now in my life, I'm opening up to letting go of everything. Everything I thought I needed, everything I thought was a part of me, everything that I thought I was supposed to do. I'm just letting go of everything. And it's more than a little scary. It's a lot scary. And so with some of these things, on a cognitive level, I know that I'm clinging to this idea of a home, a job, a life, whatever it is. And so I have the awareness of that. And I also am working towards getting to the other side of that. You know, what if it's just something different? And I can recognize it on a cognitive level. I can sometimes achieve a certain sense of peace. But it's scary. And it's distracting and all of those things. And so when I'm meditating and these things arise, I do the whole thing. I see that it came up. I see that I'm aware of it. I see that I'm about to let it go and launch it and get back to my breath until the next one comes up. And then I see it. I recognize it. Then I launch it. And I just keep doing that over and over again. And I'm still standing.
Yeah. Not for the faint of heart sometimes.
No, it's not for the faint of heart.
As you start to develop the Dhamma at deep levels, it's just like that. You know, it feels like we've lost our equilibrium because we've made so many internal changes, and now it's starting to reflect outwardly. And that can feel like a time to hold on. Mm-hmm. And all we can do is to engage in right effort and understand that we're letting go of things that we just don't need.
It reminds me of when we were on, it might have been my first retreat, suffering from some of the same things that you mentioned, and you were talking about one of the 12
dependent,
yes, the dependent links, yeah, dependent origination, and it was the first time that I was starting to understand becoming what? You know, because becoming, I don't know, a person with a house, a life, or whatever, you know. So are you becoming, you know, more, ignorant, more suffering, or are you becoming awakened? Yeah. You know, that's the experience, you know.
Well, I was going to ask you, what would you have gone through if you didn't have that practice?
Mm-hmm. Whew. Yeah. A lot of crying. Yeah, this is
better.
This is a huge tool. My toolbox is getting so big. So big, because I have so many great tools in it. And this group we have here is so phenomenal. I've learned something from everybody here tonight. And I'm so grateful David is in our family and just... No, it's, yeah, this is a retreat, this is a refuge, this is a refueling station, this is everything. So, yeah, it's been great. Yeah. And I know I'll get through it, and I know everything will be better than before, and all that stuff. It's just, like Mary was saying, sometimes you find yourself off the path, and how do you know? Because your foot is stuck in mud. You got to pull it out, and it's going to be heavy and cloddy for a while, but it'll dry, yeah, and it'll flake off, and you'll keep going, and you'll be on the path again. And, yeah, so that's what I'm doing. It's like, you know, what is that? Fall down 7 times, get up 8?
Yeah.
Something like that.
It doesn't matter how many times you get hit, it's how many times you get up.
Right, right. And sometimes I feel like that blow-up clown with the sand in the bottom, you punch and it goes down, it comes back up, and boing, it's got that smile on its face again. So, yeah. But I know it's all going to get better. It already is getting a lot better.
And as we're going through it, we recognize the dukkha that's occurring is simply part of having a human life.
Yeah.
You don't have to take any of it personally, because none of it is.
Yeah.
Lorna, you had your hand up.
Yeah, a lot of people have spoken about having
dukkha in our lives. I have noticed, on the positive side, I have noticed that when I'm off the path and experiencing frustration or whatever, I do experience it, and I experience it, but when it's over, it's over.
Mm-hmm.
And the recovery rate
mm-hmm.
after a bad experience is just kind of like phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's like time travel.
And I have actually pretended to be upset about things that I've got over because I am expected.
How could you not be upset?
Yes, I'm expected.
You should be suffering right now.
Yes.
What's the matter with you?
I have done that.
Lorna, that's,
I have done that.
That's so funny. Not funny, but it's...
But I have pretended to be still upset.
That's probably, maybe, is that part of like the mental fabrication of what's supposed to happen in this instance?
No, because I don't
condition
think,
behavior.
No, I think other people would read of my not
the
being
purple.
Upset as not being
empathetic.
You're providing their mental fabrication for them.
Yes.
That's a very kind thing. We don't want to be running around happy all the time, do we? We can't have that.
Deny anyone of their expectations.
Yeah.
But the point is, everybody has dukkha, but when it's over, it's over, and that bounce back up is all due to the exhaust
mm-hmm.
the Four Noble Truths. And you get over things a lot quicker.
Yeah, because you're not taking it personally. So it's not, what's there to be upset about? Thank you for bringing that up.
I'm working on effort with a capital E.
Yeah. Well, this is part of it right here. This is our right effort for today. So give ourselves all gold coin or gold stars. Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you.
I think because when you are in mindfulness and you're meditating and really using the framework of the Eightfold Path, I think I have my foot in the mud less. And so when I slip, and it's been a long time, it resonates like, so it's almost like, what? Why am I back here? And so, which is something I've experienced since last evening into today, and it hasn't just shifted right away. And one of the things that you say is, you know, it's not for me, it's what I hear about when something arises. I think you said it in the old format of better meditating. When you see something arising, what is it, what needs to be acknowledged about it?
That it's impermanent.
Say something like that. And so this morning in my meditation, that occurred, the thing keeps arising, and then I remembered to just say, what is, okay, you know, what is it? And when I did that, what was different was that, okay, so if you keep doing the same thing, which is nuts, right? It's a definition of insanity. How am I going to readdress? So that it helped me to figure out how to be much kinder in my work so that I can stay on the path. Because, you know, it's sort of like if that clown kind of is, it keeps popping up, but there's a lot of different forces that it's sort of like wrestling with, that it's really hard. But it was that recognition of what it needed. What was the, after it had arisen, again and again?
Repetitive? Something repetitive?
The persistent.
The persistent idea about, because it kept, because I was so, oh my God, why am I experiencing this again?
Isn't that what craving is, though? Repetitive?
Well, maybe I crave for this thing to not have happened. Why didn't I
what, you know, I kind of fell off the mindfulness track, and so, and recognize what I need to do so that I can go back and do it in a more mindful way, which means I have to make different choices and different decisions so that I don't feel like the clown puppet or the clown toy, the blow-up toy, it doesn't have an opportunity to pop back up. And I have to change that. Like I said this last week and before, if I want to feel something different, I have to change my behavior. So,
yeah.
And for me right now, it may be a different action. Yeah. And but the part that it's so weird to experience. I haven't experienced some feelings that I've experienced in a while, because I think, you know, it's like when you do use right speech, right intention, I don't have to apologize for things. I don't have to do that.
Yeah,
and I feel like. Yeah, and so it's like, okay, I did it, so it just, okay. But then, you know, it was me. It wasn't someone else who did it, so to be responsible, you know, in some ways. But anyway, so, but that whole idea of just even seeing it, making a decision, so the hard part will be when I live into that, to be mindful, to remember that you can do something different. Other people around you might expect you to do something different. So it's not quite like Lorna's saying, you know, people will expect me to emotionally take care of them and show them, you know, big tears or sadness just so that they know that you're kind of with them in whatever they're in. But this is sort of being anyway, I'm not there.
No, you're not. Thank you. I mean, again, it recognizing where to apply the Dhamma and then applying it is the essence of the Dhamma. This is, and we first have to have that level of concentration and the refined mindfulness to know what we're looking for, and then change it. And it's just that way. As we change our behavior, we change everything.
But it's, you know, it's also asking the right question.
Yeah.
Which is what the Buddha responds to in some of his early discussion, right? Like,
well, that's
some questions he won't answer.
Yeah, right? And that's the Eightfold Path is a way of framing our questions properly to know what to ask. So important.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. I really enjoyed this teaching. You know, I think for a long time I've been looking at the idea of what is it that I cling to as tangible things. And I say, well, you know, I don't need that in my life anymore, so I guess I'm not clinging to that. And I don't need that anymore, so I'm not clinging to that. But I think sometimes we cling to our own distractions. You know, like if we believe that a certain situation, we get anxious in it, and we condition ourselves that, oh, now we're in that situation, I'm going to get anxious about it. But that's a thing you can cling to, too. Your own neuroses, or your own craziness, or your own, you know, the squirrels in the box kind of idea. That in some ways, it serves us. Whether it's the way we connect to other people, or you know, in our relationships and our work relationships, that it's kind of an agreement we make with people that, okay, you're going to say that, and then I'm going to say this, and then it's going to go here, and then it's going to go there, and then I'm going to say, okay, see you next week, or whatever. We're back together and you do the same thing. But then again, it all comes back to the idea of the Eightfold Path, folding back into the Four Noble Truths, and being able to stop and ask yourself, where am I?
Mm-hmm.
Where am I in wrong speech? Am I in wrong action? Am I in wrong effort? And then...
Or right.
Yeah,
right.
Well, no, I'm saying when you're in that craziness,
yeah,
of judging yourself for where you are, it can become non-judgmental when you just say, okay, this is the suffering that exists in the world, and I know that I can respond and act in a skillful way that will alleviate the stress and move towards, you know, becoming more enlightened, more peaceful and more calm as an individual. So, it's, you know, some of it happens in a split second.
Mm-hmm.
And you're trying to force the words back in your mouth and, you know, you're trying to sort of take things back. But in the 4 year, in the 15 years since I started coming here, I've seen a little bit of improvement. I've always said I will be the last person who becomes a fully mature human being, but I guess I should stop clinging to that.
You should, Ananda.
Yeah. Yeah.
The most important thing is we keep doing it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here tonight. Good to see everybody. Got a lot out of tonight, a lot of connections. For me, this teaching on right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation, or right concentration, is like the meat and potatoes, getting to the nitty-gritty of living life. Lately, I have been really noticing my reaction to things. Like, what arises when something that's disturbing, like the whole judgment thing that goes on, and then the feeling that arises, and I'm talking off the cushion out there in the world. So then there's like a line in this that I was reading. I guess, can't see without them. If I could just, like, get this tattooed on my hand. The mind in a distracted state is focused outside the physical body, you know, and if I know that that's going on all the time, like, it's being mindless, you know, and if I could just remember that and remember that it's that sixth sense base where I'm experiencing life, and it's the whole eye-making thing.
Yeah.
Always puts me into a very subjective mind state, because that mind state doesn't stick around. It's like the time travel thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here I go again, I'm back here. I thought I left this, you know, way behind somewhere.
That's
and,
exactly what I was talking about.
And then it's like, you know, just jumping over to this agitated mind state. And sometimes I'll start to feel like I put a lot of work in to get out of that mind state and to figure out where it was all coming from. You know, I signed that contract. I'm done with that stuff. But it's living life that brings you right back to that.
Yeah.
And I think just understanding that puts me back into right view. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Just puts me right, snaps me right back into right view if I can understand that my agitated mind is focused outside my body,
mm-hmm.
and it's the whole eye-making thing, and I'm good. I don't need to go there, then all will be well.
Okay. Well, think about it. We say my mind wanders, so all you have to do is put it back on the right path.
That's right.
But I wallow there sometimes.
Wallowing the mud.
I'm wallowing right there. I'm wallowing around. I heard.
Sometimes there are potholes.
You know, and it's like this. I heard this saying before. It was like being stuck in quicksand, and then asking everyone not to make waves around me, so that I don't get, you know, consumed by it.
Mm-hmm.
And the control, if there is any, is within myself. You know, it's not out there, because if it's out there, then I'm focused outside my body again,
mm-hmm.
my physical body.
Like your mind, cultivate life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's just even if the object of our focus is something internal, it's still an external projection. It's still objectifying and personalizing whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. And just hearing myself say that. Like, I came here tonight with a really agitated mind. I just felt like a total peace and calmness come over me. Just hearing myself say that, like, almost like soothing myself, you know, learning how to soothe myself from these teachings.
It's just that way, Frank, you know. And thank you for sharing that, too, and all the discussion's been marvelous. Just notice how much we talk about as a Sangha practically applying the Dhamma. You know, we're not stuck in concepts or, you know, what this new teacher taught or anything like that. This is how it works. This is how it's working for me. It really is remarkable.
Finding it through our own eyes, because it's our path. So one week I'm going to hear this, and Frank's going to hear this, and Lorna's going to hear this. You know, and that's why it's so great you say it in so many different ways.
Yeah.
That, you know, we're going to all get there in our own time.
Yeah. But we're all getting there. We're all making the change. It really is remarkable. Diane, good to see you tonight.
Yes. I'm thinking, I'm like John. When Lorna said that she holds on to something because she thinks she's supposed to hold on to it so that other people feel okay if she's agitated or whatever state of mind kind of thing, I think I've lived in that my whole life. People pleasing my parents, and if I, you know, if something was supposed to happen, I was programmed to react that way, kind of thing. And I think I keep glimpsing every now and then a free Diane without no strings or anything attached, and I think, oh, I can't do that. I disappoint too many people. I just, you know, they expect me to be that way. They expect to fix me. They expect to do that, do this, or and then the insidious part of it is sometimes I find people that I can fix, and I realize, oh my gosh, you know, I'm playing this role over and over again. And that when you talk about letting things go physically and, you know, all aspects go, I mean, to me it's a constant detoxification of my body, and that some of the dukkha that needs to go is this old thinking. And through the you said capital E for effort. Geez Louise, that's what this takes, is, you know, capital E effort, because to pull yourself out of that quicksand, out of those thoughts, is like, you know, it takes some kind of strength, and sometimes it's, you know, maybe a little, I shouldn't do that. Anyway, I just, but it's staying with it, and I love this breath thing and the concentration. I read what you read in the about concentration, the four things of and I loved it. I read it, I woke up in the middle of the night and read it again, and I woke up three or four times just reading that again. And I, this is personal responsibility. Mm-hmm. This is me living my life. Nobody can do it but me.
Exactly.
Yep.
And I'm just...
And think about that as liberating, too, that you have the power to do it.
Mm. I haven't figured that out.
But you have the permission to do it.
I know. What I am finding, though, interesting is I live alone. And it's amazing how many voices have vacated the premises. The more I meditate, the more voices, you know, leave.
Congratulations.
And I'm more and more comfortable in my home, my own home. And I don't think my whole life I've been, and it started, you know, in childhood, that I've really been comfortable at home. And the refuge of my mind is becoming a wonderful place to be. Don't tell anybody.
I don't think I've ever heard awakening described that way. Letting go of all the crazies in my head. Pretty good. Letting go of all the crazies. Thank you. We just finished the 3 weeks on the Eightfold Path, so you understand how to integrate it. Next week we'll start, and the talk will be on the three marks of existence. I'm not sure if we're going to break that up or not. We might just do that in 1 week. We'll see how it unfolds.
I got two in one class. No problem.
We'll see. Our retreat's coming up, May 17th to the 20th. If you want a quad. It's not, is it?
I think so.
No, I was very careful. Is it? It's not Mother's Day.
I'll check after.
It can't be.
I think Mother's Day is the 13th.
Yeah, it is.
Before
Thursday. It's early in March.
Yeah.
I must have a Canadian calendar.
Yeah. Sign up as soon as you can. It helps with my planning. I think there's only one quad bed left for the women and two for the men. So if you want one of those, you better get it quick. Our painting day is March the 4th at Raritan Learning Cooperative, 1 o'clock, so put some time aside for that on that Sunday. And I think that's it. Let's finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of your breath, your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class, and for those folks online. Peace.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Sandra. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.